So then now we may slowly start with this today's lecture. Welcome to program optimization. So what did we do last week? So we started out from pointer analysis, and we realized that there are certain computational tasks for which there are nice algorithms and data structures. And then we wondered whether we can invest a little bit more algorithmic ingenuity to improve on fixed point computations beyond round robin iteration. And indeed, we were successful. We came up, or actually not we, but the world. I guess this is an old algorithm from the 70s, the late 70s. Which is this worklist algorithm. And we, in the last lecture, we kind of convinced ourselves that indeed, whenever the worklist algorithm terminates, it provides has been started for a monotonic system of equations, then it comes up with the least solution. That was the last thing. And we also convinced ourselves that there is a nice calculation of the runtime of the worklist algorithm. And in fact, I repeat it because it's so remarkable that it requires only n times h number of evaluations of right-hand sides, where h is the height of the lattice and n is the size of the system. Essentially, in our applications, n corresponds to the size of the control flow graph, and that means the number of nodes plus the number of edges. And that typically is linear in the program size. So in that sense, and I must perhaps, probably I said that already, but it is worthwhile repeating, this h is it is a factor of n better than round robin, and still it is a gross overestimation of the practical runtimes. Typically, even if the height of the lattice is quite high, the number of updates per program point is not very high. So that means even if the think of live variables, a C program easily may have up to maybe have hundreds of variables, globals or whatnot, and then that would mean that you have to iterate 100 times, and that would be kind of would not be very practical. But in fact, this is not the case. The number of updates per program point. So, are you done with the form? Are you done with the form? So then you can give it to him. Thank you. The number of updates is typically small. So in our experience, it's 2 or 3, independent of the height of the lattice. he's very fast, very great. So therefore, this algorithm is really practical. Perhaps one more thing. We not only had ordinary fixed point iteration, but we had also variations of fixed point iteration, namely an iteration in using widening, and another one using narrowing. And I may display again the algorithm. Here is the algorithm. So you see here, what we did is, when we do an update, we take the old value and take the least upper bound with a new value. Now, if the right-hand sides are monotonic, then it will always be the case that this t here exceeds the old value. So the least upper bound will return in the t. So if you have a monotonic system, we simply could use t and save the least upper bound here. That is one thing. But then there is this other variation where we do this this widening. And if we do widening, then the t might be incomparable with the original value. And you take something like you may apply the widening operator, and that means you might place the widening here. And in case of the narrowing operation, there one must be kind of, then one starts with a post solution and then iterates downwards, then one may replace, at least for certain variables, this operator here with the greatest, with this narrowing operator, but only at selected places. So, but that is all. So these are the only variations which one has to put to the algorithm to cope, to deal with widening and narrowing. Yeah. So, and so what? And update. Ah, yeah. And that is another thing. So the test. So here the test must be if one has may look back here for the narrowing. One has when does one have to do an update? Here one has to do an update if one is in the widening phase or in the ordinary fixed point iteration. Then one has to change the old value when the new contribution here is not subsumed by the given value. Now, if you do narrowing, then you expect the value to go down. So as long as you do not go down, you have to do an update. And you have to do the update clearly then with this. Yeah, that was the update operation. And you have to check, is t smaller than the old value? Then you could do the narrowing. So that is this modification here. You do the update as long as the new right-hand side still, as long as you are in a downward iteration, that is the t is definitely less than the old value. So that's that's the modification of the worklist algorithm. And so it is kind of the working horse of virtually every program analyzer out there and virtually every compiler. One has to be a little bit... so there are several specific properties of this algorithm. The first one is that it, in order to... It gains, the algorithm gains its efficiency over the and superiority over the round robin iteration in that it explicitly maintains variable dependencies. This is on the good side, but this is at the same time on the bad side. So it is works fine in the applications which we have seen so far, where the dependencies between variables essentially are the control flow edges. But we will encounter certain applications where variable dependencies are not so explicit anymore. And then this algorithm may fail because it is, how can we detect dependencies if you cannot literally statically read them off your constraints. That is the first thing which is a small drawback of this algorithm. And then there's another thing which is perhaps a drawback, perhaps not, I don't know. So there is this question. If you in essence this worklist algorithm is correct, whatever element you extract from the next from the worklist, you could take the first one, we decided for the first one, but instead you could take the last one, the middle one, any one. And that is, in most cases, it turns out, and I think until 2 years ago, I thought, we always take the first one. And then later we realized, we identified certain applications where it is very convenient to maintain the worklist as a priority queue. And then giving where one has uses priority, extracts priorities from the somehow, assigns priorities somehow, and then follows an iteration strategy where you kind of, no, and then realize an iteration strategy with follows the priorities. That turned out to be very crucial in some applications, but that is kind of in some sense, a screw which you can turn at that algorithm. Okay. And then there is another way. People have also thought, or we have, so that is, and I may, that is perhaps now you suffer from it, but we have done quite some, a bit of research on these fixed point algorithms, therefore I can tell you a lot of details. And one of these things is, there is still this, has, this worklist has certain deficiencies, and that is, you take out an element from the worklist, you evaluate it. But some of the variables referred to in that first, in the right-hand side of that first variable, you have not looked at so far. So what can you do? You can take only the bottom value there. But you could instead say, okay, now I observe that in order to determine the value of this first variable, I better should descend into the evaluation of the variable mentioned in the right-hand side. And only after I have computed that value, I proceed with the current variable. Yeah, that would kind of indicate that a recursive strategy for evaluating variables might be a not so bad idea. And that is kind of that is what we kind of worked on, and together with some of my PhD students, we came up with various kinds of algorithms in that respect. So now I may kind of present you. It's not a very long algorithm, but it's a very short algorithm, but still is surprisingly efficient. So it incorporates this recursive evaluation and has the other big advantage that you do not have to pre-compute variable dependencies. So that makes this algorithm a kind of generic solver, where your equation system or constraint system is kind of provided as a black box. And these black box solvers are the kind of, from a software engineering point of view, the best thing what you can have. So you have your specification, you have your application, which in this case is program analysis, and you have your algorithm, which is a black box. And you write down what you want to have, namely, please solve me these constraints. You hand it over to the black box, and the black box returns to you the result. And you do not have to do any pre-computation, any kind of fancy something with the variables. That is kind of the ideal world, and interestingly, one comes quite close to that with that algorithm. Yeah. So that's kind of, in that sense, this round-robin iteration was also kind of a very nice black box, because for that you also didn't have to do a pre-analysis of the constraint system or whatnot. The only thing was that you had to determine the ordering of the variables, but that was still a bit of a nuisance. So now let's see how we can do that. So that now the goal is we have no worklist anymore. We start with a variable. We try to evaluate the right-hand side. Now we hit at some variable. Then what would we do? So we then say, here's a variable. Obviously, in order to evaluate X, I have to go to first evaluate Y. So I recursively evaluate the Y. And then there is another thing. Now, since I hit at Y inside the body of X, this means that the value of Y influences the X. That is, whenever in the future we find out, Y should get an even larger value, then we know that propagates to the X and we have to re-evaluate X as well. So that in this way, by observing our evaluation process of right-hand sides, we dynamically detect variable dependencies. That is the idea. And that means we modify kind of, we introduce a new function eval, which essentially returns, it has two arguments, in particular it has a second argument. So this second argument, and essentially in the end it returns the value of that argument. But before that, it first solves that argument in the call solve in order to determine the best possible value for that variable, and also records that xi the first argument, this is the one where we are in the right-hand side of, so that is where evaluation started, that this kind of, this variable is influenced by the xj. Okay? So now that is the key thing. So in, if I may kind of make a little bit of a back something, here is that algorithm. Here we had this fi applied to eval. This is now in some sense exchanged to fi applied to eval of xi. So by that we indicate, by this thing here, we indicate that we are currently in the evaluation of the right-hand side of xi. So that is, we are evaluating the right-hand side fi. And whenever we look at a variable, we do it via this super-duper helper function, which will then return the values of the variables, but additionally record that these variables influence the xi. So that's the idea. A key change, but there's one point that we might kind of look at a very stupid system of equations, which is this one, or say this kind of constraint system. Yeah. So now you see the right hand side is just the left hand side. So what would we do? So we start evaluating the right-hand side of x, and that is okay. That tells us, please look up the value of x. So we recursively call the function solve again, please compute me the value of x. Now that would, and so on. So you see, we get an infinite recursion and no hope for termination. So this algorithm in that sense is in the current status, is not only impracticable, it virtually never terminates. It would only terminate for non-recursive systems of equations. So at some point, how can we deal with it? We have kind of to prevent the solver to descend into a variable which is already in process, whose solving is already in process. And in order to prevent that kind of infinite recursion, we therefore maintain an extra set, which is the set stable. And that is kind of, initially the set is empty, and otherwise, whenever we hit a new, we hit a variable, we check whether it is in stable, and if it is so, we do not go down and evaluate the right-hand side, but just look up the value. So that is, gives us this function, function solve. No, yeah, that's the function solve. So you call it for a variable, then you first check if it's stable. If it is stable, I return the value. I just do nothing. So if it is stable, the solve function says, okay, x is already in, I cannot do anything with x, I immediately return, without returning anything. Now otherwise, if it's not stable, then some work has to be done. But the first activity is to put x into the set stable. By that I indicate, now x is under processing, and I will not, whenever I hit it again, I will not do anything with it anymore. So the first thing therefore is x, to put x into the stable. Then I evaluate the right-hand side of x by using this eval xi. And this evaluation of the right-hand side of xi now will care for tracking the variable dependencies. That was our new eval function was good in that, and it does a recursive evaluation of all the variables which might be encountered, and it does, and in the end, this eval will just return the values which have been computed for the variables, and these will then can be used for further evaluation of the FI. Okay, so that is kind of this trick. Then here now, once we have this new value, we might again kind of look what happens. Is the new value subsumed by the old one? And if this is not the case, then please add add it to the current value of the xi, and then the next step. And now, so that is kind of, this looks familiar to us. Now, what do we have to do now? So in the worklist algorithm, we had to take the influence sets and then kind of put it into the worklist. So what do we do? We kind of also extract the set of all variable dependencies which we have collected for the xi. This is this w now. And then we make something very fancy. We reset this set I of influences to the empty set. Yeah? So the variable dependencies which we have encountered so far are not lost. They are in the W. And now, so in that sense, the set I of X I only kind of collects the temporarily accumulated variable dependencies, and we then use them up whenever we kind of schedule the corresponding variables for re-evaluation. By that, the variable dependencies are used up, and then they have to be recovered by further solving, otherwise they will never show up again. Okay, so we put them into this W and reset the influence set of xi to the empty set. And now what do we do with the W? So these are the variables from which we know that we have to reevaluate them, because they may no longer be the constraints may no longer be satisfied. So what do we do with them? We do two things. The first thing is we remove them from the set stable, because they depend on variables which have changed. So we can no longer consider these variables as stable. So we remove them from stable. And then also we kind of have to trigger their re-evaluation, and that we do by recursively applying the solve to all these elements in the W. And recursively, that means we have to apply this procedure solve to this list of variables, and there is in functional programming you have for that something like an up function or an iter, like iteration, so an iteration function. So I guess up is the name of that function in SML. In OCaml you would call it iter. So this up, I don't know, do I have a, so what is, how is this up defined? I would define it like, in OCaml I would write it like that. Let rec up f is a function which takes either, in the case of the empty set, it does nothing. Nothing. In the case of the one element set, it calls the f for the x. And in case of a more than one element set, it does the following. It first calls f for x, and then it recursively calls up for f and the rest. Okay. Now, that is again a little bit of hacking. Why did I, now for the experienced functional programmers among you, why did I add this extra special case? So, I see. So that is an interesting. So that you, since you do not know it directly, it tells me that I should make it a Klausuraufgabe in Info 2. Now, why did I put it like that? So this has the advantage of making the, if you have a one element list, or the last element in the list, for that you also, you have to, no, once again. So what is the sense here? So you have kind of the gist. So the gist is you have x1, x2, x3. Then you apply this up f. And that means you call up f for x1, f for x2, f for x3. Okay? Now, none of these calls is tail recursive. Why? Because in the end you have to call up f for the empty list. And that kind of then does nothing. So having this yellow... This yellow special case treats the one element list special, because then you do know there's after that call, so this is the last call here. The F is the last call, so you can do that in the same stack frame as the whole thing. So that means in that sense you give up the stack frame here and directly go to the call of F. And that makes, so for example, if you have a loop where you have an X which only depends on the X, then that means you would have to do, this would then call, the iteration then would be a tail recursive one without extra unnecessary stack frames on the stack. So therefore, this kind of seemingly completely trivial optimization has a big impact here on the space performance of that kind of algorithm. You might find it a completely trivial thing, but it has an amazingly strong impact. So we did experiments and it had an amazing strong impact. Okay, so that is this function up, which we do there, and that is kind of, by that we recursively solve all the variables which have been influenced by the variable which is changed here, and they are solved again recursively. So that was our idea. And we now, so here is our super duper benchmark constraint system of with three variables. And I guess for the worklist algorithm was not so bad. I guess it had 6 evaluations. Let us check here. So here was the number of evaluations. So we had 6 evaluations of right-hand sides were necessary to determine it here. And recall, for the round-robin iteration, even for that very small thing, we had, I think, 9 or something. So much more. Now, let's see what our... So, and you see, this is a trivial example, and you cannot expect to that big differences will show up. But interestingly, still differences show up. And here is kind of a trace of that algorithm. This trace is in a smaller font, because the more involved these algorithms are, the more difficult it is to track their operational behavior. And here you would see how it works. So it starts out, you start out with a call to solve X2, for example. Then you descend to evaluate the right-hand side. And evaluating the right-hand side will access the variable x3. So you call eval x2, x3. Then in order to compute the value of eval x2, x3, you will have to solve x3 first. x3, now on the right-hand side of x3 you find x1. So therefore you call eval x3, x1. And that means you have to descend into solving of x1. And now, in the right-hand side of x1, you find x3, and therefore the solver will again call x3. But x3, as you notice here, is already under solving. So therefore, then the solve will say, oh no, it's stable, I do not descend further anymore. And instead returns the current value of x3, and also records, and then the dependence from x1 to x3 is recorded. And after, so that means, so here this x3 here returns the empty, so this returns only the empty set because there is no value yet. But here for the x1, we then get the A. So this is the first evaluation of a right-hand side, which kind of succeeds, where something interesting happens. Now this solving of x1 is done. Then we kind of come back to the evaluation of x3 and record the corresponding variable dependence. And then return the corresponding value. The eval will then return the A, and then we proceed to the solving of X3. This gives us an update here. The second evaluation of a right hand side terminates with this update, and this update kind of. Then the influence set, which has been recorded, and the X3 has received here, we put X1 into the influence set of X3. So that is emptied, and now the solving of X1 is triggered, and we reevaluate the right hand side of X1, which kind of now will access again X3. X3 is, but X3 is still under, is still stable. So therefore, we do not no further evaluation and so on. So you see how that the algorithm goes down and goes up, and in the end, you may count the number of updates, the number of evaluations of right-hand sides which really took place. And you see that these are 1, 2, 3. Here is an evaluation which did not change the value of the corresponding variable. And here is another evaluation, and these are altogether 5. So now the number of evaluations of right-hand sides has dropped to 5, even in this tiny example. the other thing which we might, so that is the first thing. So the algorithm is not, once again, the properties of the algorithms are, you do not need to do the variable dependence beforehand. It will kind of recover them on the fly. And it so there is no complex pre-computation. It recovers. Now you may say this recovering the variable dependencies on the fly is an extra complication, which makes the iteration more complicated, and this is true. But it has the valuable advantage that it is able to deal with variable dependencies which change during iteration. And we will encounter such kind of applications where this is the case, namely when we will consider interprocedural analysis. So therefore, since variable dependencies may change, it is therefore good when the algorithm can adapt to these changes. And then the other thing is, and that is also an interesting point, and that interesting point is that the evaluation that you can may have different ways how to use this algorithm, and one is to start with one variable, and then the algorithm will kind of descend into all the variables which are necessary to evaluate to determine to answer your query, and to answer the query only. So variables which kind of are interesting, which are there but do not contribute to this initial query will simply not be consulted and evaluated. So you get something like in certain well-behaved applications you might consult only very few variables in order to determine your to answer your question. And that kind of, in fact, that also will kind of be beneficial here in this interprocedural analysis, where one has large constraint systems, but only a small portion of it will contribute to answering the queries. So that is also, in this sense, on the good side. Okay. Then there is a little bit of something strange, that this recursive algorithm does not evaluate right-hand sides atomically, but it starts evaluating the right-hand side, then it hits at a variable, then it kind of interrupts the current application and goes down to the evaluates the new variable, and only when it finishes, it continues with the with the evaluation up there, and that. That can have strange effects. In particular, it may fail in some cases to compute the least solution, but these are rare cases, and at least whatever is computed is typically be that everything which is computed typically will be at least an over approximation of the least solution. So here is. There is a variant of this algorithm where one can detect such situations when one when this non-atomicity may cause problems, and that is I have included it here, and I have the corresponding algorithm here, and it goes back to the idea goes back to Alex Karbicev, who was a PhD student in my group for a while. But I guess you may read it in the slides. I will not kind of further elaborate on that, because I guess you have already now seen quite interesting algorithms, and that other one is only makes a difference in rare cases. Okay, so this completes terminates the puts an end to this fixed point algorithm thing. And we now continue with more kind of analysis optimizations. So we come back to our original purpose of this lecture, and that means also that please do not expect me whenever we do now again an analysis. Please don't expect me to. Show you traces of worklist algorithms or anything else, because this is extremely and we have a hard time just to follow the computation of the analysis results. Instead, we kind of go back to this round robin thing, not because round robin is superior, but round robin is easy to follow on the slides. Whenever we kind of do fixed point computation explicitly. So now let's see here what kind of. Now I would like to come up with an interesting new idea, which is the idea of eliminating partial redundancies. So what was a redundance? A redundance you can think of, this is when you reevaluate a value which you have already computed. So that was this. For that, we had this availability of expressions. And now there is a generalization of that. This is the idea of a partial redundance. So consider this situation here. This is a small control flow graph. Here on that branch, we increment x by 1. And behind that, we again increment x by 1. Now you see... at this particular point, x plus 1 is not available, because there is a reaching path where x plus 1 has not been computed. So it's not so that I can save this kind of computation. But still, I might want to. I find it not a very nice program, because on that path here, I compute x plus 1, and then later I recompute the same value once more. So I would like to avoid this kind of double computation, even if it occurs only on some path. So what can we do? What can we do? So the idea is here. So the idea is, couldn't I do the following? I kind of say, okay, this kind of computation. So the first thing, this y2 will take. So assume that this value x plus one is stored in some t. And so this x, this y2 should receive the y2 here should be this t. Okay, so that we put the t here. But now the problem is that this t has not been evaluated on that branch. So therefore I have to add it at that branch. So I have to kind of to do compensation code. Or you could now, if you think it as a, there are two ways of how you can interpret this kind of optimization. One is you add a compensation computation into one branch here. So here's the compensation code. And because that has to be done anyway. But now by you put it into one branch, and that means you kind of you put it out, but instead you remove it here. So instead of thinking about compensation code, you could also think of code motion. So it is kind of that you move this kind of computation in that direction. In fact, you put it not only in that direction, but you also put it in that direction. Only that if you put it here at that edge, there it is completely redundant. So you can so the effect somehow is you move a computation from one point in the program to other points and hoping that in some of these points where you move them it to, they will become redundant, and then you can eliminate them there. Yeah. So you may now. How can you? So in some sense, by putting it here, this computation from here, putting it there and putting it there, you achieve two things. So in you achieve that it is in the old place, it becomes redundant, yes, so that is one kind of effect, so therefore you can remove it here. And also in the in one of the places, namely here at that point, it also may become redundant, so you remove it here as well. And by that you kind of have kind of minimized the amount of computations of that particular expression. Yeah. How can we realize this optimization? So we assume that I propose to do it in the following steps. The first thing is, now where should we insert this this computation, which is partially redundant? So we insert it at every point where the E is available, and at all points where it is required. That is where it is will be definitely be computed in the future. Okay, so that puts it in many places, and then we, if it is and then we put it there, and then we kind of may once we have inserted these the many expressions, the program has become much, much more inefficient. But then we can kind of try to remove expressions whenever they are now completely redundant. And they are completely redundant now whenever we are sure that either they are already available or they will be definitely be computed in the future, because then we do not need to compute them anymore. And that is what we would like to implement now. And you see here, there is another kind of concept which we refer to here. So one is the availability of expressions, that we this kind of property we have already investigated. But there's another property which now comes into our focus of interest, which is the property of being very busy. And very busy means that an expression will definitely be evaluated in the future. So now, when is an expression, more precisely, when is it an expression is very busy at a particular program point? So clearly it depends on the behavior of the program on not a single program path, but on every program path, and on every program path from a particular program point to the end point of the program. So it's again, like liveness of variables, a property of the future. So now consider a single program execution starting at a program point and going to the end point of the program. And then we may consider an expression E busy along a path if this expression E is evaluated along this path, and it is evaluated before any of the variables X in this right hand side is overwritten, then one would say this expression is very busy. And if I evaluate it now or if I evaluate it later, it will make no difference in the values of the expression E. And E is called very busy at the program point U if it is busy along every path starting at the given program point to the future. And so accordingly, this set B of U of very busy expressions at program point U is the intersection of all the sets of busy expressions of every path starting at U. And as before, the effect of a path composes through the effects of all the edges. So then in order to determine those very busy expressions, we again would introduce a complete lattice of potential information at the program point, which is a set of expressions, which are sets of expressions, but only sets of non-trivial expressions, and that is we again use only expressions, only expressions, and exclude the variables from it. And since look at the way how we combine the effect of different program paths, we combine them by doing the intersection. So, and that means that means that the lattice is again upside down, in that the least element is the set of all expressions, and the greatest element is the empty set. This corresponds greatest set, empty set. Greatest element, empty set means that we have no information. So then this means that we have the empty set. Now the effect of an edge, of a control flow edge, now what is it? So that it should transform the sets of busy expressions at the endpoint into the set of busy expressions at the start point of the edge. And that is determined in the following way. So, well, if you have the label of your edge is knob, then the set does not change. If you have a condition, and at the condition you have some non-trivial expression E, then you may add it to the set of busy expressions. If you have an assignment, then you have to exclude the expressions which may depend on X, because these expressions are they are no longer available, and you have to you may add the expression on the right hand side. So this is so definitely you compute E, and all the expressions which contain X they are no longer considered as very busy. And likewise, if you kind of have a memory lookup, then here this expression E is computed, so therefore this is very busy, and the variable X is the right-hand side must be kills all expressions containing X. And likewise, if you have writing to memory, then two expressions are evaluated, and no expression is killed. And here, these are the right hand sides here are as if they are there. The expressions are there. So if you have an expression. The statements here are written down as if they had not been transformed before, but if you had applied this, introduced the auxiliary variables for expressions, then, for example, this green last statement would perhaps look like T1 equals E1, T2 equals E2, and then M of T1 equals T2, and in this case, that particular statement would not change the set of busy expressions. This one would kind of add the E2. And this one would add the E1, and as the T1 and T2 do not occur as left-hand sides at other yeah no no yeah that would be the way how the computation would be done. Okay, and now these effects are again of a form which is which seems of a form which seems familiar to us. You have you take a set, you remove something, you add something. And these kind of functions, these kind of transformations, we have already systematically, we have encountered several times, and we have found them all always to be distributive. And that means if we write constraint, if we write down our constraint system for these very busy expressions and compute the corresponding least solution, then this will be exactly this merge over all paths solution. But it will be exactly in that it will be the merge over all paths solution, given that that we have this reachability, that this reachability constraint is satisfied, namely that there is a path from the endpoint that there is, so that the endpoint can be reached. So we here need, like for in the same way as for life variables, we require the assumption that there is always a path in the control flow graph from a given from every broken point to the end of the program, which is which you can easily satisfy for virtually every program, meaningful program. So now, what does this analysis now mean for this particular little example program, a control flow graph here? What would the analysis do? So now, doing just round robin iteration and round robin iteration with respect to a suitable ordering, which means have a backward analysis, so we should start at the endpoint of the program. So we start at 7. At program point 7. For program point 7, we find the empty set. Nothing is very busy there. Then we proceed to program point 6. Then y1 plus y2 is an non-trivial expression evaluated in the right-hand side of the memory write. So this gives us the y1 plus y2 here. Then proceeding to 5, we also get the x plus 1. Proceeding to 4, nothing changes. Proceeding to 3, it's still x plus 1. Proceeding to 2, nothing changes. And then in the end, going to program point 1, we observe that x1 receives a value, so therefore x plus 1 is no longer available, is no longer very busy. Yes, no longer very it's no longer very busy. And we kind of so going to program point 0, so we have to intersect the value at program point 1 and program point 3, that is, in empty set intersected with x plus 1 gives empty set. So that's it. Yeah. So these are the values which we obtain by the analysis of very busy expressions. Now, now I would call a program point U safe if I place the safe for expression E, if I may put an expression there. And what does it mean? I put it there. It means that if it it either definitely has been already evaluated, so that means it is available, or it definitely will be evaluated, so this means it is very busy. So if it is either of it at a program point, then I would call it safe. No? And clearly, if I put expressions at every safe point, because then it will a similar expression will have been or has already been computed, will have with the same result. So it does not change the value of the t, so to speak, in a meaningful way, in a negative way. Yeah. So if I compute it at an unsafe point, then it might be that I change the value at the t, and that could be perhaps would be negative. So now, what would we do? What is now the idea? So if I have an edge, then I insert the computation, any edge from U to V, then I add any computation of an expression after I compute after that edge, which is safe. And that means, so if it is safe and it has will not be computed in the future. No, sorry. If it will, sorry, no. Let me kind of so it's a little bit complicated. So what is the philosophy is now? The philosophy now is that I like to insert a computation of E as soon as possible. As soon as possible. So that would be kind of that would be the idea. So this means, well, when it is very busy at the program point, at the end point of the edge, then I know I have to compute it anyway. And then I compute it whenever it is not yet available. So that I must say. And I computed it not yet available at the end point of this edge. Now it will be, in the end, the transformation will be in such a way that it will be available at every program point where it is either has been available before or was very busy before. And that means I kind of, so that is kind of the effect. So if it is available after the transformation along this edge at the end point, so this means I apply the transformation of availability of expressions to this set, and then I get a set of expressions which will be available. And if among these is not is some expression which is still very busy, then I place it at that edge. So that's here the that would be the transformation. But let us just look at what that means for that particular program, and then I kind of we after having seen what that means for this program, I will kind of we look at the transformations again, and I also show you the guys who have invented that kind of transformation. So here is this program again. Now let us see about what happens for availability and very busyness. So availability, so we concentrate on that expression x1. So at which program point is that available? Well, it is available at program point 4, and it is available at program point 6, because at these two points it has been evaluated, and it's also available at program point 7. So that was for the availability. Now let's see for the very busyness. So it is very busy. So at program point 5. So sorry, not here, but here it is available, very busy at program point 5. It is also it is very busy at program point 5. It is very busy at program point 2. It is not very busy at program point 1. Why? Because x changes its value, and then therefore it is no longer very busy. It is also very busy at program point 4, and it is very busy at program point 3. So these are this is the region where the x plus 1 is very busy. Now then, we said we place the computation of x plus 1 at every point where it is at every edge behind every edge, where it will be, where at the end point it is very busy. So that means that is this one and that one, where they are not yet available. So that is in these places, I put the x plus 1 at the end point of the edge. And in all other places, it then becomes available. That is, at this, it becomes available. So here I can kind of use the t for it. Here I can use the t for the expression. That's it. And now you see one more thing. Here you have a variable assignment now. And here you have a variable assignment where you might where one might kind of apply our optimization to use the here in this place the t instead of the y2, which would make the assignment y2 equals t an assignment to a dead variable, which in the ultimately would remove this assignment. Yeah. So now let's go back. So these two guys are the ones who came up with that with this particular analysis, Bernhard Steffen. He's in Dortmund now for many years, and Jens Knob, he was a PhD student of Bernhard Steffen, and is now holds a chair for compiler construction at the university in Vienna. And here is once again the transformation. So here we have an edge in our control flow graph, and the places where we put computations TE equals E is now at the end point of this before the end point of this edge. So that is, we split this edge somehow and insert a few extra computations. And now what do we, for that we assume that we have already computed these values A of U and the values B of U. Then we take the union. This gives us the information that of what is definitely available at program point U after the transformation. And then this lab transforms that into a set of expressions which is evaluated, which is available at that program point. And everything there which is in this point available, we do not have to recompute, but which is very busy and not in that set, that must be evaluated, and therefore this is placed. And that is what is done here. And now then comes the point that we have the start point of the program. At the start point of the program, nothing is available. So that is, therefore, we kind of, before the start point, we add a new start point. So here is the start point. Here is the start point. Before the start point, we add a new edge, which kind of computes right in the beginning the values of all expressions which are very busy at the start point, because they have to be computed anyway, so you compute them at the earliest possible moment, and that is before the start point. Yeah, so we compute always to the earliest possible moment, and when we now that is the first part of the transformation, and you see here in this first part of the transformation we have only inserted that is where we in, inserted assignments to these auxiliary variables TE. And now the original labels of the edges, the TE have not yet occurred. So they are these values. The TE values there are then inserted in the second step. Whenever we find an expression E on the right hand side of one of the original labels of control flow edges, whenever we find an expression there, we replace it by the corresponding auxiliary variable. Yeah. So, and that we can do because we have this E, then at that particular point U, E will be very busy, and therefore we can rely on that our insertion of computations has provided assignments to TE with the current value of E. So therefore, the value is the E has already been evaluated. It is already in the TE, and therefore I can use it for assigning a value to the variable X. Okay, so that's the idea. So once again, so in this sense, so like for available of expressions, we have these auxiliary variables, and an assignment in a certain sense is split into an assignment to this E, and then later using into an assignment to this TE, and then later use this TE instead of the E on right hand sides. So that is the same as before, but only now we do not kind of these two things here are no longer this here together with the computation X equal TE equals E. They are no longer glued together, but instead we take the liberty to place these at a moment which suits us best, and we do it at the earliest possible situation. That is, at the situation where we are sure that E will later become used and where it is not available. Okay? So that is the idea. And it is... For this transformation, it is no longer as trivial to understand, and therefore it is also no longer as trivial to see that it is correct. And that is one thing. And the second thing is, it is no longer as trivial to see that it is an improvement, because it could. So for the improvement, that it is always improving, and it is always improving on, or say, it is even more humbly. It will never deteriorate the evaluation on some program execution. So that is the goal which one would like to prove. That is, on every program execution, the number, and for every expression, the number of evaluations of this expression will not increase, but decrease or stay the same. Yeah, that is the non-deterioration of efficiency, which one would like to guarantee, in fact, for any optimization, but in particular here. So now let's see for the correctness, what is kind of the idea there. So if we have a path P reaching a program point, and this program point V has an outgoing edge where E is computed, then so if E is computed after that program point, then this means that which an edge which and E is computed. Yeah, okay. So then E is computed at broken point V, and that means that there is a, then I look backward from this broken point V. So here is my super duper broken point V. Here at an outgoing edge, E is computed. That means at this broken point V, E along this path. E, so E is very busy, and so there's a maximal suffix of this path where E is very busy. So that is kind of this maximal this maximal path here. This is the maximal path. It could also be at some, yeah, it could be, it is very busy there, and the question is, where, at which of these nodes is it also available? So I take the maximal suffix where it is either very busy or very, or available, and along this path, and then, in all this path, this E will no variable in E will reserve a, will receive a new value, because if that were the case, then it would not be, it would not be very busy before or available afterwards. So that means along this all this path here, no variable X inside E changes its value. Okay. And now, where does the E is? Where then, in the end, will the E be computed? The E will be computed at the first point before it is either available or very busy. So that means at this edge here. So the computation of E will be inserted here, at the end point of this edge. And now, since all the since it is all available or very busy along all this along the whole path, this means that the variable no variable X inside E will change its value. So therefore, it is still available at broken point V, and if it's still available there, then the computation which followed here, becomes. Is available, and so this E is available there at this broken point V, so therefore I can remove it here. And that means that the analysis is correct. That is, whenever at an original edge E was computed, then the computation is then, and instead is this computation is replaced by lookup in T, then this is okay, because there was the E was computed earlier, and it's the E was computed earlier, and the correct value is stored in T. So this gives us the correctness of the transformation, and for the non-degradation of efficiency, this is more intricate, but still the argument is somehow the same. That is, whenever I insert something into a path, then this means that there will be later a corresponding computation, which is then it is very busy at that program point, and therefore there will be later on this path a computation of the expression E anyway, and therefore I insert one and I remove one, and therefore the number of computations of E will at least not increase. So that kind of this partially redundant code business seems a little bit a contrived thing, And it's not very, I would say, it does not, it is at least not obvious in which situations that might help. But there's an interesting effect where it becomes apparent that it is that really it's you can obtain very strong improvements by that kind of optimization, and that is the application to remove loop invariant codes out of loops, because that is clearly something which is worthwhile. So if you have a straight line code, so five assignments, and you succeed in removing three of these five in just this straight line code, then you have gained not very much. Why? Because this straight line code is executed like very fast anyway, so it doesn't consume a significant amount of time. So the point where you have to do aggressive optimization is not in straight line code, this is in loops, because that is what where most of the most time of your program execution is spent. So you have to optimize loops. And one way to optimize loops is loop invariant code to move it out of the loop. So here is an example. So you have this, it is a little bit contrived, but you kind of write b plus 3 to all elements in an array. But it's always the same expression, b plus 3. And this is somehow clearly stupid. This should be done once for all in the beginning and reused all the time. Yeah? And so now, again, you may say this b plus 3 has a right-hand side. I would not write it like that. My code looks different. But recall again that if you use arrays typically array expressions, array indexing, then you have address expressions which contain such kind of constant code, which then would be evaluated again and again and again, and you can't help it. So now how can we transform this kind of code? Here is the control flow graph together for that piece of code. And you see here the first thing is here you compute this b plus 3, and here you compute the indexing for the arrays, and then you do the writing, and then you increment. Perhaps it looks your intermediate code looks like that. And now what can we do? How can we optimize? So clearly we cannot optimize in that way. We cannot kind of move this piece of code just before the loop. Why can't we do it?
Because it may be computed multiple times.
So that is this one. So we cannot put it there because we are not sure whether this loop will be executed at all. If you place it before the loop, then this means that this computation will be done even if the loop is not executed. Well, in this case, if it's just a b plus 3, this is not harmful because it then only makes it a tick slower if the loop is not executed. But if it were something which potentially raises a runtime error, then we would kind of at some point introduce a runtime error into a computation where there was no runtime error before. And that would be kind of break the semantics of our program. And that would be kind of dangerous. So we better do not move that in front of the loop. And in fact, where else could we put it? So there is no decent place for it. But therefore, what one could do, and that is kind of a trick, change the while loop into a do while loop. and changing it into a do while loop means, what does it mean? So you kind of duplicate the test whether you enter the loop from the beginning to the end, and only if the condition is satisfied you enter the do while loop, and then you again check at the end of the loop whether you should jump back to the beginning or not. So now what is gained by that? Now there is a decent place for the loop invariant computation, because at this point here, this is reached whenever you enter the loop, and so that it, you can consider it as if you do a loop unrolling. You kind of copy the ones so that you, for the first iteration, you have you do it, and then you have the loop for the rest. But here, this is much better because you do not have to copy the body of the loop; you only have to copy the condition when you enter the loop, and by that, you find a place where you could put the loop invariant code, namely here after. After this condition, which tells you that you will have to enter the loop body at least once, then you do the loop invariant code, and then you execute the rest of the body once, and then check again. So this kind of transformation, which kind of so if you this transformation from a while loop in a do-while loop is a very convenient one. One might call it loop rotation, and that is actually something which is done by many compilers as a pre-processing step to trigger transformations to remove loop invariant codes to move it out of loops. And how that works, in how far partial redundancy elimination can help, this we will look at. This we will discuss tomorrow. So thank you again and for your attention. And so some people have come later. We have already done the evaluation of the lecture. So maybe you are too late now to go. but I guess. Probably we have enough opinions already. Thank you, and we see you tomorrow.